Succession number 26868, reel 11.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with Max Gamble in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 16th of the 1st, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, you were telling us about your Mustang that had stalled. You wanted to add to that story.
Yes, I did. When I recovered and managed to get some height from this thing with the ammunition covers lifting at the trailing edge and upsetting the airflow over the wing, resulting in one wing having very much less lift than the other. As a flight, we eventually grouped together and went back at around 300 miles per hour. I landed normally at the runway, but with a speed coming in at a speed of about 200 instead of, because I wasn't quite certain how the wing would react to lower speeds, and I didn't drop the flaps in case the angle of attack to the wings might create a stall. So when I landed, we had the engineers there immediately and the group captain and so on, and they immediately set up a grounding all Mustang aircraft and putting in fixed screws to hold the trailing edge of the ammunition panel cover so this didn't happen again. Now, there's an interesting thing here. It didn't happen again, by the way, that during the time I was on Mustangs were suddenly, without warning, taken off dive bombing because they thought there was something suspect in the plane. That was quickly rescinded, and we're back to bombing. Then it happened again, and the same thing, and back to bombing. Well, what in fact, this is in retrospect, had happened was that a number of test pilots had been killed in Mustangs, and they thought it was probably something to do with the dive bombing. They didn't realize, I think, that it was. The ammunition panel locking devices were not of sufficient strength to take the lift. I did confirm this with a test pilot after the war who told me that he'd been on testing these, and they did lose a number of pilots. But after the modifications were put in, that didn't happen again. So by this time, the end of the war was pretty much in sight.
I wanted to talk to you about that, and you mentioned some of the experiences that you had up until that time, but how did it feel to know now that the Germans must surely be nearing their end?
Well, one felt a little bit more confident about surviving. But I've got one interesting thing here, which happened just about this time, which demonstrates what happens if people don't more or less conform to the fixed procedures that have developed. We had one chap on the squadron who was an awkward sort of a fellow. He was near to being transferred, put it that way, but he hadn't quite sort of blotted his copybook sufficient for them at that time. And he was had been in the flight for bombing, and then we were train busting, and it was his turn to attack the flak car, because it was necessary to attack that first before going to the engine. And once you started firing at these people, you had to keep it up and keep going until you actually passed over the target. Otherwise, if you pulled up, you're an absolute sitting duck for the chaps with the guns on the flak car. Now, this chap I'm talking about, I've mentioned he was a bit awkward, but if somebody said, you do it this way, he always had his idea of doing it some other way. So the first thing he did was, when he started firing at them and the bullets were coming straight back at him from the guns, he did the thing he was supposed not to do. He pulled straight up. They immediately clobbered him. The engine ceased to function, but he had a fair amount of speed. So he was able to get quite a lot of height without the engine. Then came the business of bailing out. Now, we explained to him and insisted that there was one way of doing it which was safe. No, he decided he'd do it his way. Well, his way resulted in him getting half out of the cockpit. His parachute got partly open and wrapped him around the fuselage, half in the seat, half out, and there he was stuck with the air pressure and the bits of the parachute. And the Mustang wasn't really the easiest of planes to force land with, but one of these freaks of nature, the plane glided down without him altering anything because he wasn't near the controls, and crash landed in a field, and he was intact. He was picked up by the partisans, and he was back to us in quite a short time, about 2 weeks, I think it was, he was back. Well, after giving him a day or two to recover, I asked him to do a test flight. He refused point blank. So I said, okay, set yourself. Contacted the group captain, and he disappeared fairly pronto. But it just shows what happens when you give awkward ones who don't conform.
People talk of LMF.
Yes. He didn't actually have LMF, but he always wanted to be different. No, nobody could talk to him on the squadron, really, because the same sort of thing happened in just ordinary conversations. So that there was no weeping when he disappeared.
Of all of the duties that you were involved with at this stage, what was the favourite?
In duties, what do you mean?
Just operations against the enemy.
Operations against the enemy. Well, I don't know if there's any real favourites. It gave you a great sense of achievement if you put your bombs right on target. Likewise, it gave you a similar sense of achievement if you were able to strafe a number of vehicles or trains and see the results of your part in the war effort.
So if you were then being told, right, today we're going to do such and such a job, what was the job that was least looked forward to?
I think it was more the areas. I think the one that was least looked forward to was bombing of Pola Harbour, which I mentioned earlier, because of the extent of the Agak around that area being a port with refueling facilities and e-boats and so on. It was absolutely stacked.
In relation to the coming of, or presumably the nearing of the end for the Germans, what visible evidence were you gaining in relation to that?
Very little, really. We were being fairly successful in delaying the return of the German army towards Germany. And all that was happening was that that was being slowed down. And we didn't have much warning of it. Suddenly, we were told it was all over. It happened very, very suddenly, without much warning.
Well, let's talk about that if you're ready to.
Well,
what were you doing when you heard the news?
On this, we were based on this rather rough airfield in Yugoslavia at Zara. Supplies had been pretty short, and we hadn't had a boat coming into Zara Harbour with anything. There was no grog on the station and so on. And the same day that the armistice was declared, we heard there was a NAFI, that's Navy, Army and Air Force, ship going to arrive in Zara. So we sent off the best mess chap, the corporal, with a truck. And he got fairly well up in the queue when it was unloaded, and we came back with a fair amount of reasonable supplies and some beer and some gin and some whiskey and so on to celebrate. So that night we had everybody in the officer's mess and had quite a rip-roaring party. But most of the grog went. So everything after that was sort of in limbo. The CO had gone off to Rome on, I can't remember what it was. I think it was more a private matter, and I was acting. And I had a peculiar thing happen to me. I felt reasonably all right, but suddenly I found I couldn't stand the pain in my feet if I had to sit down. I couldn't hold a cup by the handle. I had to sort of hold it like this. Everything was painful. So I was put into the field hospital, and the doctors came to the decision there that it was a violent allergy to something or other. No idea what it was, but I was in hospital for a couple of days and trying all the time to see if it was easing, because we had been told that the partisans by this time decided they'd like to have our aircraft, everything else, and the situation was becoming a little bit awkward. And the squadron was being evacuated. Well, while I was in hospital, they got about half the squadron out, and suddenly one night about 4 o'clock in the morning, I got up and I could walk all right with no pressure or pain in my feet. So by dawn, I was ready to move and went down to the airstrip and put my various stuff together to go, and then I got in the normal aircraft that I'd been using and flew across the Adriatic to Termoli, where we were being based for temporarily for the time being. And then from Termoli, everything was very much limbo. I was doing the odd little bit of flying around Italy, doing various jobs like court of inquiries, not court martials. There were various odd sort of communication jobs to be done. And in fact, most of the time was just been loafing around. And then the AAF headquarters in Cairo advised those Australians on the squadron who'd done quite a lot of flying and so on that they were wanted back at Cairo to be returned to Australia. So my friend and I, he was the CO of the sister squadron, we wended our way back to Cairo, went to the transit camp on the Suez Canal on the Bitter Lakes, and waited with lots of others from different squadrons for shipping to get back to Australia. Wait was quite long. I think it was the region of about 8 weeks. And
given that the European war had ended, what were you feeling about your war at this stage? Apart from the fact that it was over, what were you feeling at this
moment? Well, we didn't know whether we didn't know, because there wasn't enough information available, really how the war in the Pacific was progressing. And in fact, before we were found berths on the ship back to Australia, we suddenly got the news that the atom bomb had been dropped and that Japan had surrendered. So then it was just a matter of getting back to Australia, because we knew that when we got back we would be soon after that discharged. Well, what happened was the New Zealand troops had chartered a ship, the P&O Strathmore, and there were a few vacancies in the better class cabins, and so quite a number of us with high priorities to return were put on that ship, and we arrived back in Melbourne in the first week of December. November.
Can we talk about the homeward journey and what it was like to be on board a ship coming back from war?
Well, I'd been on ships before as the sort of lowest animal life in the Air Force before flying training, which was pretty putrid and pretty terrible travel, and going back much more senior in good care was a very welcome change. Also, they had plenty of food and good food on board, and we enjoyed the trip back.
What was the atmosphere like being on board a ship of young blokes coming back from war, though?
Well, most of the people on the ship were non-commissioned people, so that we virtually stuck to the commissioned ones in the top decks. Attitude? One, I suppose, of apprehension. What's the future going to hold? Some people knew they were going back to jobs. Other ones, like me, more or less gone from school, had no job, so we didn't know what we were going to do. So after getting back, meeting up with my family and so on, and a certain amount of leave.
Before that, though, can we talk about your experience in relation to the dropping of the bomb and how the Japanese War, the Pacific War, had finished? What was the general thought about the dropping of the atomic bomb?
Information about it all was so scarce, and also everybody was ignorant. We'd never heard of about atomic energy, really, during the war. It was all fresh. So, it was one of bewilderment, really. So I think that's about all I can add on that one.
Presumably a certain sense of relief in relation to the fact that you weren't going to have to go off and fight the Japanese.
Oh, definite. Now, when you're talking about that, an interesting thing after, around about the time of my discharge, you got amongst people and said, where were you? And you said, in the Middle East and Europe and so on. And occasionally you got the odd one who said, getting out of it so that you're away from the area so you didn't get taken prisoner by the Japanese. Well, you can imagine what reply was and the strife that caused. We went where we were sent. We had no choice of where we were going. We were sent away in training. We were then sent by them. This was by the RAAF headquarters through the RAF. But I just thought I'd mention that there was a little bit of nastiness in some respects on that.
What then, to know you're coming back home, had you been in touch with your people very much during your time away?
No, because we couldn't. The only letters up to that stage that were allowable were I did call them, though they were condensed letter sheet, which was then flown from Trincomalee to Perth on Catalinas. And by the time the war was over and shipping was beginning to get going, we were on our way anyway. But the RAAF had advised our next of kin that we were coming back and when we would arrive so that they could meet the ship.
What was it like to see the coast of Australia back in view again?
Joy and relief. Very much so.
How did you see your future? Did you have any idea of what you might want to do?
Well, my father was a farmer who had been in the 1418 war, and he'd had trouble with trench fever and so on. And during the time I was away, which I knew very little about, he had heart trouble, fibrillation and so on, that had been brought on, I think, largely from his time in the trenches in 1916 or 17. And so he had to sell the farm. So, having sort of been brought up as a prospective farmer, that was gone, which I knew little about until I arrived back. So, then came the thought of what to do. Well, the thought about university. So through the Air Force, went and did aptitude tests at Melbourne University. Dozens and dozens of these, and these were really to see whether you were worth sort of sponsored. Government sponsorship for university training. Well, I was recommended on engineering or agriculture, those, and that they would pay for my university training. By this time, my brother had been in the Air Force. He was younger than I was, and he hadn't done any active service. He'd been trained in Canada, then did flying instruction in Canada, then go back to Australia just before the end of the war. He'd already started at Melbourne University. Well, there was a decision to make whether to go ahead with that or something else. The trouble was, one felt that you were getting on by this time. I was, 20... in my 26th year, what to do. And then one of my Air Force friends, who'd been offered a job in Kenya, was sent by the company he'd been with prior to the war to New Zealand as general manager, and the job that he was going to take in Kenya was open, so I applied for it and got it. So I finished up travelling later on in 1946 to Kenya and starting a job in plantations, coffee and tea.
We'll talk about that. When peace had finally come, you mentioned that there was a certain amount of bemusement, in a way. Were you completely convinced that it was now peace in our time?
It appeared so. We didn't think it would be possible for another war of that magnitude to be possible. Anyway, as we well know, anything's possible.
How did you see the world?
I think really recovering. Again, communications were...
What had you seen that made you sort of form a picture of how the world might be now? You mentioned recovering.
Well, we realised that, well, what had... that Germany had been battered to pieces, and Hitler had battered the place to get pieces. Britain was in trouble recovering, Japan in a mess, economies throughout the world weren't very good. It was more a sort of financial affair.
You mentioned re-education. What sort of education had you gleaned from your time as an airman, do you think, that you might not get in university?
University of the World, I think. A lot of living was condensed into a few years, so that one probably had a better chance of taking and responding to management and control of other people generally.
How do you view the human condition, do you think, following your experiences?
Human condition in what way?
How the human being could be. What was he capable of?
I don't really know how to answer that one. I don't think, in fact, we thought very much about that. Our life had been such a sort of narrow thing, which was, in fact, your own personal war effort to get an end to the war, but the broader picture hadn't really entered our minds very much.